One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
Well, hi everybody, how are you today? This is Mark Chappadimi. Thank you so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. Oh man, look at the date, look at the calendar. I see September 4th, might be September 3rd, depending on where you are in the world. I'm about to speak to a fantastically gifted music supervisor, Catherine Greaves, all the way from the U and the K. But looking at the calendar specifically, we're not too far from Christmas. So Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donner, Blitzen, and Martha. We're about to talk to Catherine about baby reindeer, as well as everything else she's done. Catherine, thanks for being on the show. How are things in your world?
Oh, they're very good, thank you. That was an excellent intro. I wasn't sure where you were going for a second with the lineup. I was like, Christmas? It's only just finishing summer. But no, very good. I like it a lot. But yeah, no, all good. I'm looking forward to flying out to LA tomorrow and getting some sun myself, because London is miserable and cloudy, and I think that's it for summer. So it's good. It's good that I'll be heading over the pond soon.
Excellent. Well, welcome. We're excited to receive you once you're on this side of the pond. LA is nice. California is nice. When it's not wildfires and locusts, it's actually kind of enjoyable if you don't mind overpriced real estate. But it's another topic. Well, that's fantastic. I think these days we need music to lift us up. We need movies. We need narratives. We need a distraction, because the world is crazy. So, do you go by Cat? That's what your name signed in as. Is that a
Yes, I go as either, but please call me Cat. It's quicker. So yeah, no, go for it.
Okay. Well, meow. Nice to meet you. Thank you for honoring us with your presence and your jovialness, jovialitality. Ooh, I think I just made up that word too. Jovialitality. Sounds like Italian. Anyway, I'm trying to get through all of Baby Reindeer. There's some irk-inducing moments. It's a tough sell. I mean, if you're not ready for it, I mean, it's the thing about these TV shows, you know, sometimes you might get through a 90-minute movie, 120-minute movie, and you're like, oof, wiping the sweat from your brow, but you made it. But seven episodes of just... you almost forget that you're holding your breath. So what got you on the project? What projects do you like? Tell us about yourself, Kat.
So I joined the project, joined Baby Reindeer right at the beginning. I normally join a TV show or film in advance of shooting, from script stage. So you kind of, it's great because you get to see it through every single stage, and you get to kind of experience what something's like on the page and then how it ends up right at the end. I think the Baby Reindeer was just brilliant from the beginning, and reading those scripts was incredibly exciting. It felt like a very brave story to tell. It didn't feel like anything else that was on television, which is always quite nice. I think, you know, a lot of television gets made and a lot of it is very formulaic, and this certainly isn't. But yeah, a really, really exciting script. I think when you start working on anything, it's difficult to know where something's going to end up. And certainly I didn't expect, and I don't think anyone expected, Baby Reindeer to be the kind of worldwide smash hit that it's become. I think there was something incredibly different and interesting that I think thought would appeal, I think, to a lot of people, but I assumed it would be one of those things that kind of had a bit of word of mouth and that people would gradually start watching. But actually, what happened was it came out and, you know, within a week, millions of people had watched it. You know, it was being talked about, and to kind of see that journey, I think has been amazing. I think I was on it for coming up to kind of 2 years by the time it came out. So I think I started on it in August 2022 or something like that. It was out in April this year. So it was a good old long time from kind of those early stages to the end, and quite a journey, I think, in terms of in terms of that process. But yeah, an incredible, incredible show to be part of.
Well, yeah, a journey is one thing, but let's talk about your journey. Can you go back to the very first time that music grabbed you, whether it was on the radio or your parents' record player or just something like, wow, I'm moved by this.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite a, yeah, it really is going back to the very first step. I remember, I think one of my earliest memories of like hearing music as a kid, and being really kind of, yeah, remembering how I felt was we were driving back from holiday in a car, in my dad's car. And I think I'd fallen asleep. And then I woke up and it was in the days where you had like a cassette player in your car, like CD players, unless you had a very fancy car, didn't really, you know, we're talking like early 90s, shall we say. I remember falling asleep, waking up, it being dark outside, and my dad had a Beach Boys cassette, and the song Heroes and Villains by Beach Boys was playing. And that song is really fucking creepy when you wake up. And I remember being kind of confused because it had been sunny when I'd fallen asleep. Waking up, it's dark, and this like terrifying, creepy, like layered voices. Yeah, and I remember that really vividly. And now I love the Beach Boys, but that really kind of sticks with me. And actually, I've licensed the Beach Boys for certain moments, not necessarily that song, where you need that slightly kind of chilling feel to something, but within a kind of like secure, kind of nice, joyful surface, but with something going on between underneath. And a lot of Beach Boys songs have that quality. So maybe it's all led into that. I've never actually kind of put two and two together with that memory. But yeah, I think that's maybe one of my first real like emotive memories, I think.
Well, I would say that I like that song. I would say it's a deep cut because it's funny. I grew up kind of on the Beach Boys. My dad did the same thing. Cocktail came out. So there was the Kokomo cassette and, you know, went into Little Deuce Coupe and all this stuff. But then the Heroes and Villains was used pretty well in Wes Anderson's The Fantastic Mr. Fox, which that movie itself with Roald Dahl's source material, it's kind of charming on the surface, but there's some seedy undertones. So I think that played well in that same vein. But where I'm going with this is, so when you hear a song, that's one thing. And in these days, you know, there's the idea of music subscriptions or, you know, MP3s with, you know, you kind of forget that you bought something or something. But having that very first cassette or CD, the taking ownership of something physical, what was the first thing you had to say, yes, this is mine. This is Kat. This is who I identify with.
I remember, so the first album I ever bought, obviously I hadn't earned that money myself, but I think that I ever spent my Christmas money or whatever pocket money was Tragic Kingdom by No Doubt. That was my first album. And I loved that album. I played it over and over and over and over and over again. And I think that kind of album I listen to a lot of other stuff over the years, but I, you know, my kind of soul does kind of sit in that slightly 90s pop punk. The first ever gig I went to a lot of years later when I was like in my teens was like Real Big Fish and Less Than Jake and all of that sound. So I feel like that felt like kind of me, and I really loved Gwen Stefani and yeah, that felt like a, yeah. But I've definitely bought some way more embarrassing records and that I listen to over and over and over again, you know, for the rest of my life, shall we say. So, but yeah, I think that felt, yeah, I loved that album. I think I also had Take That's first album as well. So that kind of maybe counteracts the kind of slightly cooler No Doubt vibe. But yeah, that was my first physical CD, and you read all of the liner notes and you knew every word and all of that. And I think it's such a shame. Music's so kind of throwaway now, and rather than, you know, spending so much money on one thing and listening to it a million times. And yeah, there's something quite magical about that.
Well, my wife and I were watching 10 Things I Hate About You last night for the first time in years. And what I noticed is that a lot of that You know, that's that 90s era sound, but it was also scored with kind of a ska, light punk. And I just thought, that doesn't quite work these days. I mean, I love Goldfinger and I love Real Big Fish and going back to Less Than Jake and Buck 09, stuff like that. And I was just thinking, you know, it's a time, you know, where that was everywhere. I mean, it was used in a Nickelodeon show. I think it was Kablam was the theme song to that, had a ska vibe to it. So I love growing up in that atmosphere and how that influences you. Cause you're right. Things these days just are so fleeting, but it's a great jumping off point, Kat. That's great.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever, you know, they feel very of their time, those songs. And I think also the content is very teenage as well in a lot of those songs. And so I have seen Goldfinger in the last like couple of years, but there's something that doesn't quite work when guys are like in their 50s singing about like drinking too many beers and skateboarding. Doesn't quite, like, there's something which I love and there's that nostalgia, but it doesn't quite like stand the test of time, I think, in the same way. Although, yeah, I'm still here for it. Let's put it that way.
Oh, yeah. I saw Winger recently, and I was lucky enough to interview Kip Winger. But, you know, there's that song 17. And so at this age, it's like, she's only 45. You know, it's like, you have to, like, work up these things that did seem like maybe rebellious or making a statement back in the day. It's like, and whatever it is.
Yeah. No, agreed. But it's, yeah, I still love it.
Well, you know, music supervision is an interesting discipline or profession to go after. And I'm just wondering, how did you go from Tragic Kingdom to where you are now? I'm sure you fill in the gaps for me, Kat. Tell us more about yourself.
So I didn't really know that music supervision was a job. I don't think it definitely, especially in the UK, it now is more of a, there are more opportunities, but I never kind of realized that somebody actually was, you know, it's your job to suggest music for, you know, different scenes in films and TV shows, and that was a thing. I always wanted to choose the music at the end of, there's a program in the UK called Match of the Day, which is the kind of football or soccer kind of roundup program. And at any time there was like a World Cup, and England tragically get knocked out on penalties, as happens every single time we ever play, there would always be a big montage and there'd be a big emotional song, and, you know, or on the odd occasion where you win, there's this incredible montage and everyone's like ecstatic. And I was like, I want to be the person who chooses that song at the end of Match of the Day. And so that was a kind of like thought in the back of my mind of going, well, I never actually went down that route, you know, surely that can't be a thing. But I was always musical at school. I'm classically trained in the flute. I play piano, I sing. And I did a degree in sound engineering, so on quite a technical kind of side of things, and didn't really know what I wanted to do. But luckily got an opportunity to work for a company in London that was a music supervision company and composer agency. So I got a job there kind of interning, started off doing things like burning CDs and making cups of tea and like doing all these things, like taking physical invoices and paperwork down the road to the accountants, all these things which now everyone just does over email in a way that just didn't really, you know, there was just a lot more kind of like physical admin to do back then. But yeah, very lucky to kind of, yeah, get an opportunity there and really learn the craft of music supervision. I worked for two brilliant music supervisors who, yeah, kind of showed me the ropes, and I assisted them. I worked there for a lot of years and really, yeah, kind of got into it that way. TV at the time in the UK wasn't particularly high profile, shall we say, in terms of international sales. And then we had like the Downton Abbey effect, where suddenly like UK TV shows were selling worldwide and doing really well in the US, and things like Sherlock were coming out. And it felt like there was a shift in terms of how good producers wanted their shows to be here, and music was a big part of that. So the company I worked for did a lot of big films and didn't really care that much about TV, but we started to get a little bit of TV work in as that shift was happening. And so I kind of was very lucky to get those opportunities, especially in the TV side of things, to really kind of run with that myself and get some experience from quite, you know, a relatively kind of young age in that side of things. And then, yeah, several many years later, lucky to kind of, you know, work on lots of amazing programs and kind of have my own company with some other supervisors. And yeah, so we kind of, there's a lot that happened in between, but that's the kind of, yeah, the where it started and where we are now. So yeah, it's been a journey.
Well, you kind of just made me think when you said Sherlock, you know, then there was Luther and then the Mighty Boosh and then the IT Crowd, and just all Black Books, all these ones that just like, and those ones aren't necessarily known for their music, but they do enhance it in a way that just makes it, you know, propels it, makes it absolutely a little more British and over the top, you know, pushes it home.
Yeah, for sure. I think, yeah, all of those shows, I stood the test of time and ran for many years and really were just like a whole step up in quality, I think, from a lot of other programs that made up kind of, you know, your average BBC drama. I mean, things like Doctor Who had been, you know, a big success for a while, but, you know, that kind of journey all happened. And then now I think, you know, we're quite lucky to produce some amazing shows, and that's kind of reflected, I think, in some of the, you know, the Emmys that are coming up. We have, you know, Baby Reindeer is such a, you know, one of the most watched shows Netflix has ever had. And it was a low budget, tiny British production. So yeah, we're kind of, you know, I'm quite blessed to have been on that journey as things have improved, I think.
Well, I'm looking at the track list and you've got 60 songs over 7 episodes. Now, if Spotify is to be believed, is that your total tally or is there more? It's a lot of songs.
I think the Spotify, I did actually count this up. I think the Spotify playlist includes a few score cues by the brilliant composers of the Galperine Brothers who we had, but there are 52 licensed songs still in those 7 episodes. So yeah, there's a lot of music in Baby Reindeer. And there are 7 episodes, but all the episodes are between, I think, about 28 minutes and 42 minutes long. So they're not even like full hours. So yeah, it was quite a lot of work to get it there, shall we say. But I think we actually started off with quite a small music budget on Baby Reindeer. So when I started on the project, it was like, oh, okay, well, you can probably afford 4 songs an episode at a push, and we're quite limited on what we can afford. And then what was brilliant was Netflix saw how important commercial music was for that show and what it did and how it really kind of elevated certain, was it, well, helped elevate certain scenes, but also just gave it, you know, it's a very hard hitting, dark show in places, but the songs do help kind of give it a kind of lightness. I think a lot of the songs we use slightly cut across and play against what's going on. And I think that really helps with the whole tone, and it became just a very important part of the show. And Netflix realized that, and also realized the restrictions of the original budget. So they were really supportive and helped us within reason achieve what we wanted and you know, get some of those bigger songs as well that are really important and those bigger artists. So yeah, we were very lucky. That does rarely happen, that you get more money, often it's cut at the end. So yeah, but it was a big job. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I saw Harry Nilsson on there, and I guess everybody makes the assumption that it's the Beatles, but it was Harry's song that's like, oh, you have Beatles money? Netflix has that much money, you can get Beatles? But you know, it's either a rights thing or money thing. And I guess what is, you know, to that point, what is the biggest sort of soul crushing blow that a music supervisor can get?
Well, the Beatles, we definitely didn't have Beatles money, sadly. I don't think I've ever had Beatles money on anything I've ever done. I think, you know, it's normally one of those ones where if anyone writes it into a script or puts it into an early edit, it's like, just take it out now before you fall in love with it. Put something else in there. Just don't make it harder for yourself when it's an absolute guaranteed no. So yeah, we didn't have Beatles money. We do have George Harrison at the end, which is a Bob Dylan song covered by George Harrison, but that's not the same conversation as a Beatles. That's not quite Beatles money. but also still quite a risky thing when I suggested that and was like, okay, I think we'll be okay. Surely, like, we can afford this in the last episode when I've spent most of the money. But yeah, luckily we got it all sorted. But yeah, Beatles, a hard one. I think with Baby Reindeer, we used a lot of kind of heritage artists, but we tried not to use necessarily their most famous songs. So we had like the Bee Gees and I Started a Joke, which certainly isn't one of their most famous songs, but it was so perfect for the context of Baby Reindeer. That was the first one where basically the producers are like, if we have to spend all our money on this song and just use library music everywhere else, we will do that. So it was really important that we got that song. Bee Gees are really, they're not the most straightforward artist to clear. Barry Gibb, I think, you know, has an opinion and likes to make sure that he feels aligned with how that music's being used. And Baby Reindeer is quite a controversial show on the whole. So there were quite a few occasions where we really had to, when we license music or clear music or try and get the rights, we have to be really specific about how we're using that music. We have to tell them what the show is and how it's being used in that scene. So we did have some issues on Baby Reindeer in certain scenes where it was a particularly controversial or difficult moment. We did have some artists who didn't want to have their music associated with that scene. In episode 4, there's a scene where there's a montage of Donnie taking a kind of concoction of drugs, kind of anything you can imagine he's taking in this montage. And I think we tried 4 songs before we landed on Wilco, who said yes, we sent them the details and they went, not for us, thank you. I wonder if they're still thinking the same thing now that it's so big and the kind of impact of that. But yeah, there's definitely, it can be tricky if there's a controversial scene to get those rights. But it's part of my job to help explain that and sell it in the best way and explain why a scene is so important and where something on the surface might not be something you want to be associated with, the deeper meanings behind that and how that works. So yeah, it's all kind of part of my role.
The two standouts for me, I would say, in maybe music supervision are American Psycho, where you have this extreme audiovisual counterpoint. You have Phil Collins, you have Huey Lewis, I think it was Huey Lewis, then you have Whitney Houston, and then you have Shorzy, for instance. So it's like one is absolutely the antithesis of what's going on. The other one is just like amping you up. So it's great that artists, when they get, you know, get the request in context, do they get to see the episode play out? Like how much are they told? And then how does the pillow talk work? Do you send them a box of chocolates? Do you, you know, send them love letters every day? Please, we love your music. Put it in. Like how does all that work?
So it all kind of depends. Normally we just write a description of how the music's used. It can be quite difficult to send out clips. However, we do, if an artist insists on seeing something before they approve it and say yes, we facilitate sending out those clips. We can't do it for everything, otherwise we'd be here forever. And also just the security of sharing things as well and things getting out. So sometimes we will share that when we need that extra context and an artist like is on the fence. Other times we will send letters. Richard Gadd did write a few letters on baby reindeer, some of which got those uses over the line. Other ones didn't make any difference, and we still couldn't afford the fees that they wanted. But yeah, sometimes we can get you know, something written when something is particularly personal to the showrunner, writer, director. They write a letter to why that, you know, why they want to use it, and a kind of wider context that kind of taps into a slightly more emotional aspect, rather than a kind of, you know, this is what's going on in your scene and why that artist is more important. So there's all kind of ways that we can try and get permission when at first it's a no or somebody's unsure. And yeah, and also it's kind of my relationship sometimes with the record label publisher, who can, you know, who's having this conversation directly with the artist. If I have a particularly, you know, I work with them very closely, you know, they can help translate that sometimes and talk people into something that perhaps they might want more money normally. But, you know, there's just a way of kind of making sure that we're communicating in the best way. I've never resorted to sending gifts, but, you know, let's never say never.
Well, I'll forever remember that scene in The Christmas Story where Ralphie brings the fruit basket to his teacher, and the narrator goes, "A little bribe never hurts." And I'm always just thinking about like that. It's like, maybe just little gift giving. Well, you know, there was a meme quite a few years ago where it was, I think it was like a six box grid of photos, and it listed professions. So it's like, what the world thinks I do, what my parents think I do, what I actually do. So I'm wondering, can you break that down? Because I'm sure if somebody knows that you're a music supervisor, they're probably like, hey, this song would be great. And like, your inbox is flooded with like suggestions, and you guys go, no. Like, so how do you break that down? What would you say that you do?
So what I do is I kind of bring together the musical vision on a film or television show. So that varies depending on who's involved and how musically involved the creatives on that project are, so the director or the showrunner. So on some projects, I will turn up and, you know, I will read the scripts, and I very much kind of guide, I come up with the initial ideas of like, why don't we try this? Why don't we do this? Here's a big playlist of songs. Which ones like connect with you? And we go from there. And then, you know, we have a collaborative dialogue. But the kind of musical sound, I guess, is very guided by my initial ideas. Other times I turn up and there are strong musical ideas from the showrunner or the director, and I take those on board and go, okay, this is great. How do we develop those? How do we get the important songs that are really important to that person? And how do we build out on that and, you know, widen the soundtrack and keeping within their taste, but maybe making it more affordable? So it's kind of any kind of scope from that, kind of on the creative side. I send music in, I hear what other people like, their ideas are, we have back and forth. And then my job is to make sure that that is all facilitated and cleared, and we have all the legal permission that we need in order to actually use those songs. So every single song, when we clear it, we have to get permission from the songwriter and the artist via their publishers and labels, and we have to negotiate a fee. So everything is down to an individual negotiation. So I have to have a lot of conversations and then make a judgment as to whether the fee that we agree on is worth it. And, you know, if we have a really expensive song in one episode, it means we can't have as expensive songs on other episodes. So it's kind of managing the whole process and just making sure that we're making the best decisions for the whole production, and kind of feeding in ideas to solve any of those issues that we can't afford, and just generally trying to kind of curate and make sure that that we end up at the end where we have everything cleared, everything, permission for everything, on budget, and everyone's happy, and the music we're using is making that episode or film, you know, pop, and, you know, elevates it and you know, adds to it. So I guess that's kind of the general oversight of my job, I think.
Well, I love how you encapsulated it. Captured it. So one of those words will work. Well, I think it's exciting too, because this is my take on it. So Baby Reindeer felt in a way timeless because a lot of the selections had a folky element to it. So it felt like it was dancing the line between madness and, I don't know, hysteria. I don't know if there's a good way that Martha leaned, or even Donnie, because I think they're more alike than they would assume. You know, you could get sort of maybe is either death metal or complete lunacy, but I think that the folky nature of it just set the tone for it. So I guess what I'm asking is, well, you know, whether it's Wilco or George Harrison, was the MO to kind of give it songs that had a certain pace to it? Were these selected because it was not fast, not slow? You know, what were the selections made with that in mind?
Yeah, I think so. To some extent, I definitely think we were drawn more to songs that, I think most of the songs have a certain kind of energy and a pace to them, even if lyrically they're incredibly melancholic and sad. I mean, the Wilco song, How to Fight Loneliness, is like a case in point, because actually it's quite a kind of mid-tempo, kind of like strums along, you know, there is a bit of like an energy to it, and the lyrics are incredibly poignant, and it kind of, so the music almost plays against what's going on lyrically. I think lyrics are really important to the songs that we chose. I think every single song has been thought through in that way that we use, but that I also think, you know, it was important that the music did drive it on, because I think it would be very easy to just, you know, drag it into the dark elements, and actually just, it kind of gave it a kind of lightness, I think, and a slight innocence as well, I think, in parts. I think, yeah, that was all kind of taken into consideration. But we just kind of found, I mean, we did start off from a kind of like 1960s, 70s, like jumping off point, and Richard wanted a very kind of timeless score, and he'd put in, I think, Dusty Springfield into the script, and Angel of the Morning. And they, you know, just as like ideas, like playing over montages, which normally when that often happens, and screenwriters will suggest songs as they're writing, because that might be what they're listening to. And then when you get into the edit, those songs don't always work. But actually there were a couple of moments in Baby Reindeer where they did. And that was a really good jumping off point for us, because those sounds really worked. I think there was a real kind of joy and kind of purity to the love songs that are of that period, which really played against the obsession of Martha. So, you know, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, playing in episode one when we just meet Martha. And, you know, there's all of those that kind of, those moments that really help kind of slightly play into the comedy, slightly play against the kind of, you know, the reality of what's going on, but definitely kind of, yeah, gave us a good place to start and kind of build the soundtrack from there, and yeah, keep that kind of everything rooted in kind of 60s and 70s, but we do obviously kind of branch out from there as we go through the show.
Before we go, I'm curious about something. Is, I know it's having all these lines of communication open to make connections and get the rights. Do you find it better or easier in an absolute pinch to say, scrap the song, we're going to get a source cue composed? Or is it better to take out a source cue that's not working and throw in a song?
Both come up. I think a song can does a different thing to score. I think when you need a piece of music to really storytell and change within a minute, you need it to do something different at the beginning than it's doing at the end to help kind of work with that narrative. It can be quite difficult to use commercial music, and that's sometimes where it fails, is where you start off, you land a song at the beginning of the scene and it's great, but then by the end of the scene the emotion's changed. But normally songs are pretty static in terms of how they make you feel. They don't go from here, you know, from up here to down here within, you know, the verse to the chorus. So that's sometimes where score kind of works better. And sometimes those decisions are made very much in the last minute. Other times you just can't afford every single song. And so if you can use some score somewhere, it can be really helpful to do that rather than using a commercial song. But commercial songs can also kind of paper over some cracks in the storyline. Not that we had that situation on Baby Reindeer, because it's an incredibly, you know, well-written and amazing piece of work. But I have worked on shows which potentially have needed a bit more help, and you can stick a big song on there and everyone kind of, you know, their focus is off the slightly bad acting, or, you know, the script that isn't working, or, you know, those moments. So songs can be really helpful in a way that score can't be, but then score, on the other hand, can tell that story in just a way that you need it to do, and that songs can take away from actually what's happening on screen. So it's always a balance of ultimately you're supporting the visuals and the story, and that needs to be the most important thing. And so, yeah, when you get that balance right, which I, you know, think and hope we have done in Baby Reindeer, is a real, you know, it's a real good feeling, I think.
Well, I'd say you got there as a team, bunch of creatives, professionals of the highest merit. But I have to ask, going out, is there a holy grail song you're going after? And if you could dip back into Cat's CD Projects binder from the 90s, there's got to be something like, I cannot wait to use this.
Yeah, I have like, I do have like a list of songs that I kind of have probably like tried to get into TV shows and films over the years, and probably like, you know, if anyone paid us any attention, be like, oh, I'm sure she put that forward for this TV show and now it's in this thing. But yeah, I think you always want to put your like favorite artists in shows where you have those songs that really mean something to you. But then at the same time, you also don't want to put those songs in, because once they're like, once you've done that and there's that moment for that song, then you kind of don't want to do it for a second time, and suddenly it will like change the context. So I'm not sure if there's like a specific thing. I mean, like, my ultimate favorite band is Pearl Jam, and I've never licensed a Pearl Jam song for anything. Not that I haven't thought about it, but there's never quite been the right scene or the right tone, and I work on kind of like weird British stuff and they have a very American sound, so that sometimes just hasn't like linked up. But yeah, I would love that. But also, it's I think my listening taste and my kind of music supervision taste don't always, you know, what I listen to at home isn't necessarily what I immediately think about going to in terms of like licensing. So, and then putting forward for shows. So it's, yeah, every project is individual.
Well, Jeremy doesn't work very well, but maybe Why Go On does. So who knows? you might get there one day.
Absolutely.
I got to say, it's been tremendous speaking with you. Everyone check out Baby Reindeer on Netflix. Check out Kat's work. And until that time, we will catch you next time.